Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Dr. Peter Bregan, and today is a big day for me and my radio show. First, I have a really good guest, but in addition, it's the second day of my book being officially on sale, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. The book is out now. You can get it on Amazon, and also book is on sale on our website, and the hang on a minute here. Yes, my wife just walked in, very confused because I'm on my handset rather than Skyping, and she looks at me like, "What is the matter?" Well, for some reason, the connection didn't work through Skype today. But anyway, first time I think that's happened. But at any rate, the book is out. And we're mailing out copies now on from our website, where we're offering a really unusual promotion, which is you get a copy of Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, and you get a copy of the Antidepressant Fact Book, which itself sells nearly for as much as Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety. We just have this offer as long as the Antidepressant Fact Book holds out. So as long as we have them in inventory at the special price, we got them. I want to tell you that despite the ominous title, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, this is an interesting book. You know, let me read you just quickly the first three chapters of the part one. Chapter one is the most violent and most loving creature on earth. So I start out with the fact that humans are the most violent and the most loving creatures on earth. That's each and every one of us. Then I talk in Chapter 2 about, quote, our human legacy of Stone Age emotions, emotions that were built into us genetically and developed in childhood that are really quite primitive. And then the third chapter is our brains are made up of people. This is a discussion of how our brain develops in response to the nurturing around us, and so that literally our brain grows in response to the people around us. And the fourth chapter is the social carnivore emerges from Africa. What it was like for us to come out of Africa as these deeply violent, deeply social creatures, and how in the world was evolution going to let us even keep from tearing each other apart? And the answer is, as you'll see, that guilt, shame, and anxiety performed a function at one time through natural selection, but do we really need them anymore? Part two is about achieving emotional freedom. Chapter 12 in part two, taking the three steps to emotional freedom. Chapter 13, identifying feelings of guilt, shame, and anxiety. Chapter 14, recognizing feelings of anger and emotional numbness. And it goes on, talks about how we feel our emotions in our bodies and gives tests for you to decide what's your emotional profile. Guilt, shame, anxiety, anger, emotional numbing, and describes just what we need to know to leave behind our primitive, what I call in this new theory, negative legacy emotions. And then finally, part three is freedom to love. And the first chapter in part three is love is joyful awareness. The next chapter is let's talk about sex. The next chapter is love is not the same as relationship. And then I go on from there and try to help folks learn to live loving lives. I've been working on these ideas since I was probably a child. I literally began drafting this book 40-plus years ago. So this is the book of my wisdom about life and overcoming our negative emotions and living creative, responsible, productive lives. Now, how in the world does that relate to my next guest? My today's guest. Well, amazingly so. But you won't think so at first. His name is Michael Fontaine. He's an associate professor of classics, and he's associate dean of the faculty at Cornell University, right here in town where I am in Ithaca. He's become a friend. We met, and you kind of get the idea how and why. He publishes on Latin literature and ancient Roman society. By the way, Michael, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you, Peter.
Is Michael there?
Yes, I am, Peter. Can you hear me?
Michael is right now not there. Are you there, Michael?
Yes, I am, Peter. Do you hear me now?
I don't hear you, Michael Fontaine.
Well, how about now, Peter?
I hear you a little bit.
Should we turn up the volume a bit?
Yeah, now I hear you. I didn't hear you at all for a minute. Folks, this is because of all the high tech. Michael Fontaine is actually in a high tech center at Cornell. We expect performance out of Cornell here with you on the phone. I expect you to sound better than me, who's on a hard line. How can you hear me now?
I can hear you perfectly well, yep.
All right, I got you. I'm getting you now. Okay, well, Michael, as I mentioned, is an associate professor of classics and an associate dean of the faculty at Cornell, and he publishes in Latin literature and ancient Roman society. He's an author of Funny Words and Plautine Comedy, P-L-A-U-T-I-N-E, Plautine, and he's co-editor of the Oxford Handbook of Greek and Roman Comedy. Now, obviously, that is an interesting man on the face of it, somebody who would be the co-editor of the Oxford Handbook on Greek and Roman Comedy, and that's published, that's just published this year, goodness gracious. Now, we get into how he somehow got interested in psychiatry. He read the famous Rosenhan experiment, you know, where fake patients were sent into emergency rooms and said things like, I hear a voice saying, hello, and they all got locked up, and they all got drugged, and they all supposedly got better. And the only people who knew they weren't patients were the other patients. He wrote a paper on this, which I'd like to hear some more about. I haven't actually read it yet, on being sane in an insane place, the Rosenhan experiment in the laboratory of Plautus Epidominus. He's going to tell you how to pronounce it. This was published in Current Psychology. It was reposted on Zos.com. Many of you will know that website. And a video version is hosted on Mad in America, where else? And his latest project is to understand how people coped with personal distress before the rise and fall of Christianity. We're just going to have a, I hope, interesting conversation. I pray it will lead to a collaboration. Michael, welcome to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour.
Well, thank you so much, Peter. It's really great to be here, and congratulations on your new book. It's a great read. I wanted to point out real quick before I forget that you talk about human beings being the most loving and the most violent. You kind of reactivated an idea that's very, very old. In ancient Greece, the Ares, the god of war, was the consort of Aphrodite, the god of love. Those two are always associated. So I think you've hit on something, some ancient myth, whatever it means, and sort of put your finger on that. But let me give your guests, maybe just or your listeners, a little bit of context about what classics is, because certainly at Cornell graduations, a lot of people show up not knowing what it is we do. So classics is the study of ancient Greece and Rome, and we should put some dates to that. So ancient Greece really gets going about the year 3000 BC, so almost 5,000 years ago. And that is when all the great Greek literature, the art, the architecture, everything started to flourish, especially in Athens in the 5th century BC, so about 2,500 years ago. And after Athens went into decline, Rome took over in Italy and lasted for about 1,000 years with all sorts of great literature, all sorts of philosophy, all sorts of things that we still have today. If you go to Rome, you'll see some of the great temples. And so you mentioned the article that I wrote. You're exactly right. I got interested in the Rosenhan experiment purely by serendipity. There was a call for research on ancient medicine. I was not an expert at all in that sort of topic, but I do study this Roman playwright named Plautus. He was sort of the Shakespeare of ancient Rome. He wrote 21 comedies that you can still read today. That means stage comedies in the same sense that you'd see with Shakespeare. And in one of the comedies, there is a psychiatrist. Now, that's not the word they call him in Latin. They call him a medicus, which is just a doctor. But he is what you call a Hippocratic doctor, someone who studies Hippocratic medicine and subscribes to the theories. The play is a very, very funny play about twins, identical twins separated at birth. And one goes looking for his brother about 30 years later and arrives in town where his long-lost brother lives. And they miss seeing each other all day long. So the guy comes to town, the new guy comes to town, and everybody naturally assumes that he is his brother. What makes it worse is that they have the same name. So everybody starts to assume that the other person is crazy, and they start saying, "You're insane, you're crazy," and so on and so forth. And finally, he can't figure out a way out of the fix, so he says, "I know what I'm going to do. Since everybody says I'm crazy, I'll pretend to be crazy, and that'll scare him away." And then he says he can hear the god Apollo telling him to get violent, or he can hear the god Dionysus telling him to get violent. And that freaks everybody out, so they summon the doctor. And in comes the doctor, who assumes this guy is sick because that's what everyone's told him. And he attempts to diagnose this guy, Menaechmus, the new guy in town. And he decides, so as the doctor comes in, just before he comes in, the two twins switch places. So in comes this purely innocent guy who lives here in town. Has the same name, same life story.
God, it is like the Rosenhan experiment.
Exactly,
this is amazing.
It's exactly like it. The doctor comes in, he says, pardon me, I don't mean to speak over you. It's exactly the same. The doctor comes in and he says, I can set bones. I know what to do. I promise you I will cure him. It's interesting that the relatives go to get the doctor. I think that's kind of a common feature in psychiatric scenarios today.
You bet. It's always been, but I didn't know it was way back then. This is all news to me.
Oh, sure. So
go ahead. This is fascinating.
Well, the doctor says, I am going to examine the patient, and he starts asking him a series of questions. And, of course, what it makes it interesting is the brother who lives in town, he doesn't have any idea what's been going on, but he's a lawyer, and he's had a rotten day at the office. And he says, I'm going to kill that idiot client, that moron who made me miss my lunch, all these things. I'm so angry. And so every gesture, all his irritation, everything becomes seen as what you would call, I guess, a symptom of insanity. And the doctor starts asking him questions. They are exactly the kind of questions we know from the ancient medical literature are the very same questions any doctor would have asked you back then. And there are a number of plays on words in the Latin text so that I guess you would call the guy the patient, although it's not the right word. He would say X, and the doctor would assume that he was saying Y, even though it's the same word. And at the end, the doctor concludes that the guy is crazy, and he summons four big men to come and take this guy away, and he tells the father-in-law, he says, I'm going to give him drugs, a course of drugs for 3 weeks, and I assure you that'll make him sane. And it is, as you said, exactly like the Rosenhan experiment. It's remarkable. So the conclusion I drew from studying this comedy, now it is meant to be funny, but the conclusion I drew was that these comedies are social commentaries. And the Latin comedy that I'm talking about was based on a Greek comedy probably from 100 or 150 years before, which would have been written about 60 years after the Greek doctor Hippocrates was the first person in history to come up with what you call the medical model of madness. So that was a new idea, and you would expect that as soon as somebody says, well, all this nutty behavior, that's really a brain disease, you might expect there were some skeptics born in the very same instant.
This is fascinating. This is all new to me. Do you know Tom is gone now? Did Tom know about this play? Because this is the kind of thing that would have just made him happy as a clam.
Well, this is what got me so interested in things. As I may have mentioned, I came about all this purely through serendipity. So I didn't know anything about psychiatric controversies, had no involvement with psychiatry in my personal life. And so I read Rosenhan's article, and I started to put it together with the play. And that led me, reading Rosenhan and some of the reactions, led me to Tom's stuff. Now, he was very busy, but I sent him the abstract. I got in touch with him, and I couldn't believe he only lived an hour away by car from me. I sent him the abstract, and I said, would you mind reading this? And he says, well, I'm busy, but I'd like to. He asked for the Latin. He wanted to read the original Latin text. And he was going to give me comments. He didn't quite get around it. And I said, well, let me come visit you, and let's at least spend some time talking. And we probably had the most amazing 2 or 3 hour lunch conversation I've ever had. I told him at the end, I said, I think I'm having lunch with Galileo. And that actually brought a smile to his face. But as you know, he's gone now. He never did get me comments on the article. So I don't know exactly what he would have thought. But I do think that this comedy goes beyond what Rosenhan was saying. So Rosenhan, as you know, he sort of stared into the abyss and then he averted his eyes. And Tom said, well, the problem with Rosenhan's study is Rosenhan assumes that the what he calls the pseudo patients, they were all sane, but that everybody else inside the mental hospital, they were really crazy. And Tom said the problem
with that.
Yeah,
that's right. He had a fairly traditional view of psychiatry.
He says the problem with this, right, is that Rosenhan just proved that doctors can't make a valid diagnosis. So what's the basis for thinking all the other people inside are crazy? And I read that and I thought, boy, I think I've just glimpsed into the abyss too. So that was the conclusion
I
drew.
How did this play end? Did you tell us how it ended? Is that how it ends?
Not much. In the play, what happens is after the scene, the second scene with the doctor ends, is quite remarkable. The character who's just been diagnosed as crazy turns to the audience. And the word, by the way, in Latin is insanus. It is the Latin word insane. The English word insane comes right from Latin. And he says, and he looks at us, and he breaks the dramatic illusion. He says, can it be that those who are saying I'm insane are really insane themselves? And so the play goes in a different direction where his manservant comes and fights off the four guys who have come to carry him away. And the play ends a bit more farcically, but that, I think, is really a serious moment. And let me tell you why the study of literature, I think, is so important for all this stuff. I was just reading a short story by the Brazilian novelist Machado de Assis. Do you know this story? It's called The Alienist.
Yes, I think so. It's quite an older book.
Exactly.
I think I read it in a translation a long, long time ago, or maybe looked at it. But go ahead.
Well, your listeners should absolutely read this. It's outstanding. I think it was published in 1881. By coincidence, there's two brand new translations out just last year. And I was reading it, and it's a satire of a doctor who moves to a small village in Brazil and decides he's going to open an asylum. And by the end of the story, he has put everyone into the asylum. And so, you know, the reach of what he's trying to cure gets further and further. But he has a character in the story say exactly the same thing that we see in Plautus's play. A guy turns to another guy and he says, can it be that this doctor who's saying that everybody's insane is really insane himself? And I find this fascinating. If there are no objective anchors to what this idea insane means, why are we using the word?
Well, as Oz taught us, to empower the medical psychiatric establishment and to impose social control on people we don't know what else to do with or we want to control. I am trying to wrap my mind around this, that within the same generation, basically, or a generation after Hippocrates, who was at least the first we know of to be medicalizing insanity, that skeptics were so prevalent that there's an actual play by the leading playwright of the time ridiculing the attempts to distinguish people into the sane and insane, and at least the medical professions attempt to do that. Is that fair to say?
It is, but I think I'd qualify the number of skeptics. So one of the great things, or sad things, depending on how you think about it, about skeptics traditionally, is that it can be pretty dangerous to be public about your skepticism. So we don't really
know
how many.
Well, I know that. I can talk
sure
about that for 5 hours. Yes, 3 days, maybe a whole book. Yeah, go ahead.
So we don't really know how many skeptics there were. We do know there were religious skeptics right around the same time. But what makes it a little easier in ancient Greece, and then again in Rome, I think, is that in the ancient world, there were three ways of thinking about what we would call mental illness. So the Hippocrates model is the medical one, and that was basically what you would call chemical imbalances. They call them humoral imbalances, but it's exactly the same idea, that the fluids inside your brain are out of whack and they need to be adjusted with drugs. The other models, though, were supernatural, that you're possessed by demons or something like that. And we don't think that anybody, for the most part, the literary artists and the people that we read, none of them really believe that. But the last model is philosophy, and that's the model that's closest to psychotherapy today, the idea that you could talk your way out of these things, that you can make a change in your life, and you could let go of some of these ideas that are not making you happy. And that is what it's what I find interesting. The reason I think classics is relevant to psychiatry is that people who study Greece and Rome, as I do, study the human condition of men and women in Europe before the rise of Christianity and before the fall of Christianity. And by that, I mean institutional Christianity. So in the 4th century AD, in the year 381, it became the law that you had to become a Christian. So everybody became Christian for the most part. And where they didn't, there was friction. So those are the various clashes with Jews and heretics throughout the up until the Reformation. And then with the Enlightenment in the 17th century, institutional Christianity and the 18th century, institutional Christianity declined. And with it, philosophy went out the window because religion had subsumed the study of philosophy as a personal way of conducting your life. And so people that chose no longer to believe in religion or in God or something, they often are casting about for values, philosophical values. So I think a lot of people latch on to health and they think, well, if there's nothing after we die, no heaven, no hell, then I need to extend my life and be as healthy as I possibly can at the expense of everything else. And I think that bringing back some of the ancient philosophy, you know, adapting it for modern circumstances might make some people happy if they knew what the ancient philosophers had to say.
Folks, this is Michael Fontaine, Associate Professor of Classics and Associate Dean of Faculty at Cornell. And the Greek playwright he's talking about is Plautus, Plautus, and then Epidamnus. And would you pronounce that again for us?
Sure, it's Epidamnus, and that is simply the name of the city where the play takes place. It's in Albania today.
Ah, okay, so that's the name of the place.
That's right.
The play, actually. Now, has that play been put on in modern times?
It is often put on by graduate students at universities. I saw a production at Harvard back in 2001 or 2 or 3, thereabouts.
Yeah.
And it was outstanding, outstanding.
You know, if this play were made into a movie today, it would end with him being cured by the drugs. That's what happens with movies today, or they don't get made. The drug companies interfere, or the psychiatrist or the director interferes. But I'm thinking there was more freedom then, obviously, to challenge these ideas than today. I mean, that's quite astonishing because none of today's leading playwrights is writing anything that stands in opposition to institutionalized psychiatry at all. I mean, it's forbidden. So, I mean, it's so interesting to go back and also to see that human intelligence doesn't necessarily evolve. It was high then at its best, looking at issues in ways that we still have trouble looking at. Does that seem reasonable to you?
Oh, I'd agree completely. Human life, day-to-day life, was about as comfortable in the first and second centuries AD in the Roman Empire. If you lived in the first and second centuries AD, your life was about as good as it was up until the time of the American Civil War, just 150 years ago. Now, they didn't have antibiotics. They definitely had painkillers. They didn't have medical insurance, though, and I wonder if that plays into why the psychiatric drugs become so popular. Right. I mean, if you wanted these medicines, you would have to pay for them out of your own pocket back then. There weren't a lot of options, although they definitely did have a substance, hellebore. I don't know much about its pharmacological properties, but people have studied it. I did make a mistake in the paper. I think I called it a neuroleptic, which is not correct. But it is, you know, in spirit, it's akin to the same kind of thing. It has, I think in toxic psychiatry, you referred to the lobotomy effect of these drugs. Is that right?
Yeah.
Idea that you can blunt people's thinking chemically. Now, of course, they drank tons of wine back in Greece and Rome, so they certainly used alcohol.
So is hellebore what was probably given to in the play that the equivalent of hellebore was being given?
Well, that's what they say in the play. The doctor says, I'm going to treat you with a course of hellebore. And and so that's when the four strong men come to take him away, and the guy's manservant runs up with a sword and fights them all off. And that sort of ends the bit with the doctor, and then the play goes in a different direction. But it's remarkable. It'd be remarkable to see a production of this play maybe updated for a modern audience. It could certainly be done.
Well, it's been a while since I looked at hellebore, and I'm just doing a little search on the Internet as we talk. And I'll see what I can find out. This is, to me, we had no idea this is where we were going. This is so important for folks to think about how long-term these issues are, how they're not science-based issues. They're really issues of what are intelligent people going to be thinking about these issues based on philosophy and psychology and religion and their experience. And, you know, the solutions are not gonna come through science to all of this. They really have a basis in philosophy, psychology, world viewpoint, and so on.
So, Peter, I've been thinking about it
on a track. Yeah, go ahead.
I've been thinking about an analogy for all this sort of thing. I was going to try it out on you and see what you think about this. That is to say, for managing anguish, let's call it anguish because maybe there's not a better word. But I think the closest analogy would be obesity today. That is to say, you can manage obesity through mechanical means, right? You can put a belly band on someone's stomach. That would be kind of sort of like lobotomizing somebody's brain or electroshocking the person.
You don't destroy the soul's ability to express itself when you, do an operation on the stomach. So in a way, the metaphor is good, but it falls short because brain operations, unlike heart operations or, in this case, stomach surgery for what might be viewed as a psychological issue, at least it isn't damaging the brain.
Oh, absolutely. I would agree with you. I think that... Is lobotomy legal still in the United States? Is it practiced?
Oh, yes. There's still some going on. Not much. I conducted an international campaign in the early 70s. It was really the beginning of my being a public figure. And I took on the AMA and the APA and managed to stop most of the psychosurgical projects in the Western world and some of them over in Asia as well. But they still go on. They just don't publicize themselves. But they certainly are still going on.
Yeah. And the electroshock is still used as well, I believe.
More than ever. Shock more than ever. Yeah. In fact, probably within Syracuse and driving distance for Syracuse, there's several, at least three or more places you could drive to that would give you shock treatment and tell you it was a miracle cure when all it's going to do is damage your brain. We have 1 minute left before the break at this point. We're coming really near the break. I just want to introduce people to you again. This is Michael Fontaine. He's a professor, associate professor of classics right here at Cornell with me here in Ithaca. And he's developed this great interest in psychology. And we've gotten together and been talking. And for the second half of this time, we're going to talk about... The notion of guilt, shame, and anxiety over the ages, which, of course, fits so well in having my new book, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, coming out now. So we'll go to music and to break, and I hope you're enjoying this as much as I am. I think this is a stunningly important discussion by Michael Fontaine. And thanks for listening, and we will be back really soon.
PRN.FM.
Hi, Michael. Hi. This is wonderful.
I agree. I'm having a great time, Peter. And congratulations again on your book. I'll mention it. I'll make a point of saying it. How long are we on break for?
Until the music starts again, which is about 3 minutes or so.
Oh, okay. All right.
They're doing little ads for the station and stuff like that.
So have you had any idea of how many of the books have maybe started to get ordered already?
No, I can't tell anything yet. The big moment is next Tuesday or Wednesday when I go on for 3 hours onto the biggest evening talk show in the country, Coast to Coast. And I'm talked to 6 million people for 3 hours around the book. That's going to tell me within the next few days whether people want to read this or not.
Well, that's great. Yeah, I mean, that's really exciting.
It's on the starts at 1 a.m. here, but it's 10 o'clock on the West Coast, and it's George Norrie's Coast to Coast. I'm his psychiatrist in residence.
That's
great.
And
he's going to give me 3 hours. Actually, I'm not going on until 2 a.m. our time. Until 5 a.m. I'm going to be talking about the book. But there'll be millions and millions of listeners, so that's going to give me an idea.
That's great.
Yeah, we haven't barely started the advertising. I've done a couple of little national shows. Well, I think this is going marvelously, and I would like, how much of the book have you looked at?
Oh, I read the whole manuscript. I'm afraid I didn't bring
fabulous.
It with me, though, to make any notes on it or anything.
So did you haven't told me what you thought about the whole manuscript.
Oh, I did. I thought I sent you some comments, but I thought it was great. And the question I want to ask you about is what role you think language plays in all of these different things.
Well, probably a lot, but it's not my special area of thinking, you know?
Right, sure.
It's not linguistics and language. It's not. So let's talk about that.
Okay, sure. So I do a little bit of that with language and philosophy, so maybe I can sort of fill in some cracks, or you can challenge me and tell me it's not right.
Yeah, we'll have a good conversation about it. Now, you've probably sent me this paper on Rosenhan. I've been bizarrely preoccupied with different things.
First internet radio station on Google. Thank you for helping us move forward.
Greg, an hour, and my marvelous guest. My gosh, what a wonderful first half hour. Michael Fontaine, Associate Professor of Classics at Cornell, and the author of, among other things, the Oxford Handbook, co-author of it, of Oxford Handbook of Greek and Roman Comedy, published by the Oxford University Press this year, and also a marvelous paper out in Current Psychology called On Being Sane in an Insane Place. And in that, he applies the famous Rosenhan experiment to a Greek, a Roman play based on an old, lost Greek play.
That's exactly right.
And you can find a video version of this on Mad in America, where I now blog, by the way. My first two blogs on Mad in America, the first one is up. Just did stunningly well. We had over 10,000 downloads. Just stunningly well. I'm glad to be on Mad in America. And my book, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, is out. You can still get, until the books run out, a marvelous combination of Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety and the Antidepressant Fact Book for the same price. And I really have written Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety so that you can use the book to understand in a whole new way why we all suffer from these negative emotions, how to handle them, how to get rid of most of them, and how to live a life based on principle and love. It's a handbook. Chapter one is a background of about evolution and why we have guilt, shame, and anxiety. Chapter two is about how to identify it and how to see it as weeds in your garden that you can pull out. And chapter three is about how to grow flowers in your life, how to grow love and principled living. And my guest, Michael, I emailed him a final pages, proofs of it before the book came out. So you've had a chance to look at it.
That's right, yeah. I think it's a fantastic read, and I do congratulate you on it. It's clearly taken you a lot of thought to put all these ideas together.
Well, good, good. Now, you had some new ideas about guilt, shame, and anxiety for us. First, based on classics, and I'm going to love to hear about that, and maybe into a slant you have that I don't usually get into, which is language, linguistics, and so on. But let me give you back the microphone.
Well, thanks, Peter. The angle that I take an interest in is how these emotions have remained constant or maybe changed over the years. And my first impression is looking all the way back to the beginning of Greek and Roman literature 3,000 years ago is that nothing's changed on planet Earth whatsoever. The emotions are identical. They're readily identifiable. The literary authors that talk about them don't necessarily always talk about, say, guilt. For example, Homer's Iliad is a famous example where there's not much evidence of it. On the other hand, these were real people. They were the ancestors of many of us, many of your listeners. And so we assume the human condition has remained stable. Certainly many of the Greeks thought that the human condition remained stable. So as I think about these issues, it's interesting. Guilt is the one that attracts my interest the most because in English we just sort of have this one word, guilt, for the legal sense as well as for the moral sense. In other languages, of course, those are at least two different words sometimes. So in Latin, for example, the word for guilt in the legal sense is culpa. You know that from culprit and exculpate and those sorts of things. But the word for the moral sense of guilt is conscientia. That is to say, it's the same word that gives us the English word conscience. And the idea is that you are aware of this sense of what you've done or haven't done. And the question is, why do we feel guilt? Why can't you just do something bad and not worry about it? But I think when we do have people that have that reaction, we tend to see, don't we call them sociopaths? Isn't that the word that's commonly used for those
kind of
things?
I think that's the latest. It's hard to keep track.
Yeah.
The psychopath during most of my training.
Okay, it's changed. And so the question is, where does that come from? Again, you're the expert here, not really me, but I would think that it is maybe a projection of the survival instinct. You can abstract that immediate fear of danger into the future, or you can brood on a matter because you have the capacity of language as a human being to think about what you've done wrong, and you can't get the ideas out of your head. How does that strike you?
I think that's the more academic kind of way of, I'd say that's what how I might think philosophically about it, but I don't think that's what's going on. First of all, many people do horrible things and feel no guilt at all. This is an important fact of life that we struggle with desperately. It's not just, quote, psychopaths who do horrible things and don't feel guilty about it. It's all of us at one time or another in our lives where we have felt justified in doing what we do. Most people who commit murder, for example, and I do a fair amount of work in that area forensically, most people who commit murder feel justified because somebody shamed them. Mm. Somebody humiliated them. The people who were burning buildings in St. Louis do not feel guilty afterward. Mm. So one of the main points of my book is that feelings of guilt actually have no particular relationship to actual personal responsibility for something. They are actually built in, first, in a very gross way. I don't think it's a big consciousness issue. I think they're built into human beings over a couple of million years as we evolved in order to manage this paradox of how violent we are and how loving we are. So that natural selection favored people who would not express all their violence and willfulness in the family setting so we wouldn't destroy each other with our violence. This is the new theory, the theory of negative legacy emotions, so that it's built into children in a conflict situation, and even infants, I think, and certainly toddlers, it's built into them in conflict situations with adults, in particular, where their life might be at stake, or at least their nurturance, to react with mind-numbing, inhibitory emotions that take different forms in guilt, shame, and anxiety, but all of which basically inhibit self-expression, inhibit the pursuit of self-interest, inhibit us from asserting ourselves. And this combination of being genetically programmed and then struck down by the events of childhood, most of which we can't even remember, most of which are very arbitrary. We might get a shame reaction out of one thing and a guilt out of another, but somebody else, another kid might react differently, or the parents might instill guilt and shame differently. It's all very haphazard. And by the time we get to be adults, and I see this every day I do therapy, and I see it in myself and people I know, that when we feel guilt, shame, or anxiety, it may have nothing to do with any justice sense, any sense of really what's appropriate in life. It has no rationality behind it, generally speaking. And, of course, sometimes we feel guilty about doing something bad, but that's simply because that's the way the cards fell in the development of our guilt, that we would feel guilty. But we're more likely to feel guilty about things that we should be doing than about things we shouldn't, like standing up for ourselves with our parents, standing up for ourselves in our marriages, and so on. So in a nutshell, I don't have an existential kind of view anymore at all of guilt, shame, and anxiety. I don't think they serve a useful purpose in adult life. In evolution, they serve the purpose of keeping children and perhaps adults from killing each other in their intimate relationships. But we can do better than that now as mature human beings with a few thousand years of culture behind us. That, in a nutshell, is how I just don't see this as an existential or even a rational issue. Your response, sir?
Well, there's certainly a lot to digest there. If it's instilled in us, if it's instilled in us in childhood, that's basically saying, I would imagine, that it's universal. Everybody's going to have this. Because if I remember in the book, you say that even a look from the father that stops a child from doing something naughty is enough to give rise to this emotion. Do I remember that part right?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
I'm describing the little boy sitting at a campfire.
That's right.
Admiring his daddy, the great hunter who kills mammoths and earlier creatures. And he's sharpening his own little stick, which is all his daddy, you know, in a band, uses against these animals. And he's thinking, well, I could be a hunter. And he looks at his little brother and he thinks, I could hunt him. And then his father kind of sees him looking at his little brother and holding the stick, and his father looks at him. And the little boy, because it's built in, it's instinctual, is going to be overwhelmed with guilt, shame, or anxiety, depending on his own personality, depending on just what the father tends to instill, what the mother tends to instill. And then when he grows up, he may have trouble even standing up to his little brother without having any idea how he got slammed when he was 6 years old or 5 years old, and his brother was 2 years old. So these things then slam us in adulthood, inhibit our willfulness, even when necessary often, and we really need to think through our values and reimpose good ones, not respond to just plain negative emotions, but respond as much as possible, I believe, to loving emotions and empathy for our basis. I actually think guilt, shame, and anxiety do far more harm than good.
So I'm with you 100% in what you just said. This whole thing is a question of values. What are the values that you call them legacy emotions. That word is spot on. This is the stuff we all grew up with, the baggage that we got from our family or didn't get from our family, but we all had to grow up somehow. So what are the choices we're going to make in adulthood? And I think you're right. We need to spend some real time and effort thinking what it is we want out of life, what is going to make us happy, what might not make us happy, and how to get rid, as you say, of these unproductive emotions that are simply inhibiting us from pursuing happiness. Of course, the problem, did you address this in the book? So once we discard certain values, we better make sure we have others in place, right? Because you can end up doing some damage. If you decide to live a guilt-free lifestyle, I mean, suddenly you could hurt other people around you inadvertently or not. So what's the remedy for that?
Well, my impression is that actually that isn't what happens. theoretically, it's possible. But in my experience, and this is, of course, my work for many decades, when people let go of guilt and shame and anxiety, they tend to become more loving. They literally tend to become more caring human beings when they let go of those negative emotions. Now, that's not going to be true of somebody necessarily who was brought up in a way that they actually can't get to their loving feelings, and they're just going to manipulate and use people. And there are some people who do manipulate and use other people who are free of guilt, I suppose. But, you know, see them in therapy. But by and large, the kind of folks like you and me and the folks listening here and their families, if we let go of guilt, shame, and anxiety, we're going to be more loving, more caring, and more responsible. Mm-hmm. This is certainly true in my own life. It's certainly true in the lives of many people I know, and it's true in my work. So in that way, this is a radical concept, because one of the things people really get hung up on is and I've had people say this to me at conferences when I first began to discuss these ideas in the past year or two. Well, you know, I think that guilt tells me when I'm doing something wrong, and that's good for me. But as we start to talk about it, we find out that what do they mean? When do they feel guilty? Well, it's often when precisely they should be actually promoting themselves. They may feel guilty about speaking up to the teacher who has given their kid a hard time. Hmm. Rarely is it, I hit my wife, felt guilty, and never did it again. It's more likely you're going to not hit your wife because you love her and you see what it either did to her or would do to her. Or you scream at your kid when you're angry. You feel guilty, you may not deal with it at all. Or let's say you don't take care of your finances. You feel ashamed about it. You feel guilty about it and anxious about your finances. You may never look at them at all. But if you get rid of your guilt, shame, and anxiety about your bad behavior in the family, your harmful behavior, or about your finances, you can think about it. You can reason about it. And human beings who are relatively free of horrible emotions tend to be nicer people and more loving people. That is, without a question, my experience. And I think it's also the message of the Judeo-Christian philosophy and, to some extent, most religions, that we let go of the guilt, shame, and anxiety, and we can actually become more loving human beings.
So, and that last bit there, I think you might have touched on something I know a little bit about from my academic work, and that is how Judaism and Christianity have a role in guilt, shame, and anxiety. I mean, you've probably heard all the jokes that guilt, shame, and anxiety would describe a Catholic school education for 12 years or something along those lines. But that is to say, prior to Judaism and Christianity, and really in for the majority of people in Europe before Christianity, there was definitely guilt, but of a different kind. It wasn't pervasive. There wasn't the sense that there was a punishment waiting after death, or that you had sinned against God. In Rome, for example, in ancient Rome, the emphasis was on performing a ritual correctly when you prayed, rather than what was really in your heart. So the sense that God knows what's in your heart seems to me, you know, a major source of stress for a lot of people. And so the Romans before Christianity and Romans aside from Jews, many of whom lived in the Roman Empire, they felt guilty in other ways about other matters, but things that were at least arguably within their control. I've got a practical question for you, though. Those of us that have small kids, how do we prevent imposing guilt, shame, and anxiety on our kids? I, for one, would love to know some practical things that could be done.
Well, we got 15 minutes left. let me address the first question too. No question that culture affects profoundly the expressions of guilt, shame, and anxiety, and that is not just human culture, animal culture. You know, there's culture in the chimps create culture, and cultures vary in different groups of animals. The culture vastly influences it. And Christianity and Judaism, I think, have had this paradoxical effect. On the one hand, the orthodox and traditional educations often instill an enormous amount of guilt, shame, and anxiety. On the other hand, the more profound message of God loves us is and that we should relate to each other through the golden rule. We should love God and love one another, which I think is the ultimate Judeo-Christian positive message. You know, love God, love one another, and be secure in God loves you. And there's no sense that that will lead to bad behavior. That will only lead to loving and caring behavior. And I actually believe all that, and not in an institutional religious form, but I believe that that is a good way to live our lives. So there's this ambivalent message out of Christianity. I think it's so interesting that from your perspective, guilt, and what about shame and anxiety were experienced very differently in the pre-Christian era. Can you say more about that?
Sure, absolutely. In ancient Greece, I would agree with you, too, that the ethics of these religions are outstanding. Love your neighbor as yourself is absolutely fantastic. In Greece, it was very different. It was help your friends and harm your enemies. That was the going ethic for the majority of Greeks. You can see why Christianity ultimately appealed to these people, and many of them converted down the line. Shame played a greater role, certainly in Greece. In Rome, guilt seems to have played a large role. But there were definitely questions in both societies about how to negotiate shame. Ostracism is a word that you know. I wonder if you know where it comes from. There's a Greek word, ostrakismos it is in Greek, and it means the practice of kicking out somebody who is becoming too big for his britches. So Athens, as everybody knows, was a democracy. And if any individual seemed to be getting too powerful, everybody would take an ostracon, which was a broken piece of a pot, a clay pot, and they would write your name on it, and then they would tally up all the votes. And if you got too many votes, then the community would ostracize you or excommunicate you, and you had to go away for 10 years and live somewhere else. So the community there used it as a real check on political power, on, you would say, social power, social capital, whatever you want to call it.
It's the ultimate shaming and the creation of abandonment anxiety.
Yeah. So there's one more piece of literature I wanted to see if I can get your thoughts on. So one of the
And then I do want to get to the children issue briefly, and I do discuss that in the book, in Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety.
Let's talk about that then. That's
fine.
Well, okay, there is a Greek tragedy. There's a Greek tragedy by Aeschylus, one of the great three Greek tragedians. It's called The Libation Bearers. And listeners can find a copy of the English text online anywhere. And in the play, a guy says that he hears Apollo's voice, and Apollo, the god, is telling him to kill his mother. He doesn't want to do it. So he is about 20 years old. He comes back home. He tells his sister that he hears Apollo's voice telling him to kill his mother. And for various reasons of revenge, they want to do this to their mother. So the guy is hesitant, but he goes and he murders his mother. And as soon as he's done, he sees an apparition of what he calls furies, avenging spirits rising up, and nobody else can see them. It's just him. And he says, these are dog women that are chasing me all around the place, and they're never going to let me go. And it's quite interesting that in ancient Greece, everybody says that at the end of this play, the hero, his name is Orestes, goes crazy after he kills his mother. And in their interpretation, they think that these furies are a manifestation of hallucinations. Whereas I read the play and I think, boy, he sure sounds like the typical person you read about in the news who says, God tells me to kill my mom. And when he's done, it is the voice of regret that he is seeing. He's being haunted by guilt, by sort of an abstraction of guilt. And so you could argue instead he returns to sanity. So it's interesting to see how people don't really necessarily have a clear idea of where guilt is or what's causing guilt. I wonder if you have any thoughts about that.
Oh, I just think it's a wonderful analysis again. I just think it's amazing. I actually had no idea the richness of the classical literature in trying to deal with, you know, I'm aware of Hamlet and Shakespeare and much later stuff. But I'm not really aware, and of Oedipus, I'm aware of Oedipus, but you're just enriching just my whole knowledge of how folks struggle with these these issues early on of what is madness and what is justice and what is real. I just think it's absolutely fascinating. I hope you will write a book, or maybe we could think about a book on the implications of madness in classical literature. Has that been done, Michael?
It has, but almost always by people like me who come at this from the academic angle and not by someone who has been a practicing psychiatrist.
Yeah, because we're not smart enough.
I was going to say the opposite. Here we go. Absolutely. It sounds like a great idea.
Let me briefly say that about children. You know, in many ways, relating to children and relating to each other as a husband and a wife in a marriage are very similar. You really want your child listening to what you have to say and taking it seriously, because you've created an environment of love and respect. So if you're thinking about how to raise your kid and how to maybe solve a really difficult problem, the first thing has to be created in the family is respect. So mom and dad have to do something that modern parents have a lot of trouble with. You have to go ahead and actually take moral responsibility for your family. So you have to have an attitude that you're teaching your children, not yelling, not making them feel bad, but to show the authority. It's taken for granted. And if you actually assume that role day in and day out, children will gradually begin to learn that they are supposed to listen to you. And I think you never respond positively to anything remotely disrespectful. I sit in family sessions where a kid scowls at his mother, and his mother says, "What's the matter, honey?" instead of, "Are you scowling at me, Jimmy?" And I'll intervene and say, "Jimmy, I thought you'd see you scowl at your mother." So we want to teach our kids to be respectful, and we can set boundaries. And the most important boundary is respectfulness toward all people, not whether you agree with your mother or the teacher or whether you like the other children in the class. All human beings get treated with respect. And if you get that across, your child is going to thrive in almost any environment they're in, and especially the home, too. And the second thing you want to get across is that they are lovable the way they are. They are loved. Their behavior may need correction, but they are loved. So you want a mix of unconditional love, and you have to practice it because the kids will knock it right out of you. So you practice unconditional love, and you practice setting realistic limits. And one limit that's inviolable, which is we treat each other with respect. That's kind of a thumbnail. And don't use guilt, shame, and anxiety to change your child's behaviors. They're going to get plenty of that from their siblings. They're going to get it from their peers. They're going to get it from you when you lose your temper. They're going to get it in school. And if they go to church, they're going to get it there. So you encourage your kids to have a loving attitude toward themselves and other human beings and to treat people with respect. And again, this is just applying to psychology, the ageless wisdom. We're getting near to the end here. Michael, thank you for being on the show. Let me remind people who you are. We're talking with Michael Fontaine. He's Associate Professor of Classics and Associate Dean of the Faculty at Cornell University. He's a tenured professor, which allows him to actually speak about psychiatry, because you get slammed if you are critical of psychiatry in general and in all places pretty much in our culture. And he's written a very interesting paper on being sane in an insane place in current psychology, but you can find a video version of it on madinamerica.com. I think we're going to hear the music pretty quick. You have a parting thought for us?
I just want to say thank you very much. It was a great pleasure being here.
It's a great pleasure, and I'm so glad you're here in Ithaca so I can actually call you and have lunch with you. Ginger and I very much enjoy your company. Okay, folks, a great show, and I hope you all had good Thanksgivings and have a good holidays coming up. Bye-bye.